This is Icon Art Radio. I'm Bill Teeple. I'm here with Alan Cobb and Donna Colby, and we're the hosts. What have you got for us today, Donna?
Well, since I've been preparing for a presentation on Kandinsky lately, and we're sitting here recording the show at this point, surrounded by paintings that are going to be in the Contemporary Realism show at Icon Gallery, I thought it would be interesting to talk about the relationship between abstract painting and realistic painting, or abstract images and realistic images. And so I found some ideas from Kandinsky himself, and these were early on in his career in 1910, when he was just barely beginning to shift into abstract images along with figurative ones in
and
his
we
art.
Should, I'll just put a sidebar here. Yeah. We have to get our heads screwed around to what it was like in 1910. Landscapes and historical paintings and religious scenes and portraits in very realistic rendering were what was accepted as art. So any of these kinds of, I mean, a shift in attention to come up with abstract art or abstracted art was very radical. Mm-hmm. So we can see his thinking and moving in this direction, I'm sure, as you speak.
Yes, and his particular form of figurative art was very related to the folk legends of Russia and mythological themes. So a lot of art back then was mythological themes according to their own cultural way of relating to that. And so he has wonderful, colorful, almost mosaic-like paintings in those early years of these figures in the Russian landscape, and knights, and you know, people on horses, and kings and princesses and things like that. And that was his, that was where he was at the time, and then he made the shift. And that, so what he said at that time, he said objects, what he discovered in painting objects, and he, in addition to the folk paintings, he also did street scenes in Moscow, because he was in love with the buildings and the colors in Moscow and the way the light would hit them. He said, objects have a particular spiritual sound which can and does serve as the material for all realms of art. He was very into synthesis of art forms, you know, and music and visual images. He had synesthesia, which Alan has told us about on the show before, where people see a color associated with particular musical notes, and Kandinsky had that. But anyway, in painting objects figuratively, he wanted to capture that spiritual sound, and he often would do that through color. But he said that at a certain point, he wanted to begin, quote, dissolving objects. And the reason he wanted to do that was to make the emotional overtones, what he called the emotional overtones of this spiritual sound, dominate. So that when the viewer looked at the painting, it was more of a direct communication with what he saw as the real essence of that object. So anyway, I thought it would be an interesting thing to talk about in light of these paintings that are around us here today that are very figurative and realistic, but to me also emit that spiritual sound.
Well, I think that's what the artist is tuning into. If a good artist, some artists are able to kind of capture some value of the surface level of the object, its material form and shape and basic colors. But the great artist is the one that can pierce through to the spiritual sound that's emitting from that object. I've never used that, I've never heard that term, but it's very perfect. I think that there has always been an abstract element in painting. And when you look at the great paintings of the Renaissance, the realism is so finely rendered, and the story is so compelling, we don't realize that the underpinnings are absolutely perfectly harmonized abstract paintings. So the abstract structure and the use of color and the that each form emitting that the soul of that form is in there and always has been in there in the great art. So it's like what happened with the 20th century, and I think the camera had something to do with this. The artist's eye as a way of recording events in society was no longer needed. So the artist had to find kind of his purpose as a creator. And Kandinsky was one of those who pioneered this new direction, where we started to leave off the surface level of the thing in the story and went more for the poetic essence. And so you had artists like Matisse and, well, the post-impressionists, Van Gogh and Gauguin and those guys started to get more into the subjective experience of what was before their eyes. And then you saw Matisse and Picasso abstracting the forms even further. And then Kandinsky and Malevich and others, those were two of the spearheads, dropped the form altogether. And then we had pure non-representational abstraction, which is really, now we had visual music and how the soul is stirred by a symphony without there being any representational object is what started to happen with these paintings.
And there's a story about Kandinsky. Did you ever hear the story about how it first started? He walked into his studio and there was a painting either upside down or on its side or something like that that he'd been working on.
I think I've heard this, but go ahead.
And he walked in and it just immediately hit him as being, you know, filled with, I guess, what he called that spiritual sound. And then he went more closely and saw that the painting was on its side, and that sort of gave him a clue. Well, it was interesting when you were talking about the Renaissance painters and how there were abstract elements in their art. They actually were very consciously aware of the principles of sacred geometry. And in their compositions, you know, the triangle, right, and the golden mean and all of that, the relationship between all of those geometric forms was placed with great awareness in their compositions.
Right, before they ever put they started with a story, then they would work out the composition, and then they'd basically clothe it in the imagery.
Yeah.
But underneath, the underlying geometric structure was very precise, and that's the abstract structure that I'm talking about.
Yeah, that's what I thought. And it worked.
And they were very
too
wakeful. I mean, they really knew what they were doing,
and yeah,
lots of time went into each painting, especially the planning of it.
Because when you go and you stand before one of those paintings, even if you're not particularly interested in the subject matter, something happens. It, just like when you go into a cathedral where that same kind of geometry was used in creating the spaces, you may not even have anything to do with that form of religion. You know, you may not go into it as a place of personal worship, but you go into those places and you feel something deep and sacred and bigger than you just because of that consciousness that was put into creating that form. That's probably what Kandinsky meant when he said that what he called that spiritual sound can and does serve as the material for all realms of art.
Well, and I think the poet and the various art forms are tuning into that. I mean, their eye and their heart and their ears are tuning into the depths of what's before their eyes. And you can then extract any realm of the senses from that to speak with and about.
So why do you think certain people become very attached to one form or the other? They are like very pro-realism and anti-abstract art, or the other way around.
Well, there's still vestiges of that here in the Midwest.
Mm. But
I thought we had that behind us many years ago, coming
but
from
it's the
California.
Other way around, you know,
when I grew up in the 50s,
yeah.
I guess it was my cousin's husband or something, ran the art department at one of the colleges in Southern California, and he was an abstract painter. And so, but my family was just not educated in art, and so they assumed art was being able to make something look like something. Mm-hmm. So he was always sort of marginalized and joked about. Of course, he was the head of the department of a significant art department in Southern California, so I'm sure the people around him and he and his friends and that circle thought the others were very, you know, backward and behind the times. But there was definitely two camps. This is what I'm getting at, this yeah. thing you're bringing. There were, I grew up in the middle of two camps. The people that thought art was being able to render things correctly, and they thought that abstract art was like a joke. I mean, just that was not art. And then those who, of course, were initiated into the realms of modern art, which had by that time become the art of the academy. That was what was being taught in the schools. Cubism and formalism had become, in the 40s, it sort of took over. And that was what was being taught in the schools. So that whole crowd, which later became, would be known as our contemporary international art world, they of course looked down on the people who didn't, you know, who just liked realistic painting. I think we have matured somewhat in this day and age, where there's much more appreciation now amongst those who are interested in abstract art in the full range, and realism has kind of come back. That's one of the reasons I'm doing this show right now, mm-hmm. is that there's a great deal of interest in the rendering of the objects as objects.
Well, and some artists like Will Mentor combined realism
and this is what I'm saying. You're finding a lot of mixture now
yeah.
in the postmodern period. Well, it isn't just two camps any longer.
Right,
both
right.
seem to have grown to appreciate the others. And there aren't that many provincials left, except I've run into them here in the Midwest, who are stuck in that thing of the abstract stuff is not art.
Well, my family was like that too when I was growing up. My father's brother and his wife were the ones in the family who liked, they were from Maine, and so it was modern art. They liked modern art, and we would go to their house, and there were abstract paintings around on the walls, and my family, my parents, when we went home, would make wisecracks and jokes.
No, it was
about
a butt of a joke.
Like, as if they were just trying to be yeah. show-offs by yeah. putting these paintings, you know, obviously they must not really like them. They must just be putting them in their house to be cool, you know.
Well, and then my kid could paint that,
right,
all
right,
that
yeah,
stuff.
That
and
was another one.
Yeah, you know, you have a brush to a monkey and he could do that. There's all that, those jokes about it.
Well, and it was confusing to me because I was a little artist and would draw in my room and all that. And my dad was a brilliant man, and so it was hard not to take his opinion for something. But he used a lot of his brilliance to be witty and make wisecracks and put things down in a smart way, you know. So I didn't know. When I would go and look at those paintings myself, I was almost afraid to admit that I may have liked them. And I was afraid to ask my aunt and uncle to tell me about them because I didn't, you know, it was like a confusing thing to be pulled in two different directions by two sets of relatives that you loved and respected. So it took me a long time on my own and being away from home before I could investigate art myself and see what I actually felt about it.
Well, and it says a lot about prejudices and alliances and all of these things that apply across the board in culture.
Yeah.
It's interesting how I experienced that because my family didn't have any strong positions on art one way or another. But I spent so much time at the Metropolitan Museum that I was, you know, deluged by all periods. I mean, not a tremendous amount of modern, but a tremendous variety of art. And I was seeing wonderful similarities between the relatively modern material and the Egyptians, because they were right next to each other in the museum. And the Egyptians were doing really cool modern things, simple, you know, elemental forms and strange abstract symbols that were quasi-recognizable. And the shapes of their, you know, structures were wonderfully elemental, and of course the pyramids. But I also was very struck by two things. I mean, when I think in the most general way about what I saw at the Met, you know, from the age of 7 or 8 up until, you know, 14 or so, I see two things. I see rooms just jammed with riotous complexity, and rooms with stunning elegance. And so much of the oil paintings that are there from the great sweeping history of European oil painting are in fact fabulously complicated. You know, there are scenes that are 15 feet wide and 10 feet tall, and they're just packed with stuff going on, you know, telling an entire history of a period of some country's, you know, heritage. And then there were the moderns, or the beginning ones, the, you know, Surratts and stuff that would just completely violate everything that the other ones were doing. And they had a complexity of their own, but they were also wonderfully simple in comparison. And I became very tired of the classical paintings. It was eye fatigue. The compositions were not discernible, especially when you're standing in a gigantic room with 30 of them in it. You know, you need to take some time with each one and somehow not see the others, and that's difficult to do. So when I saw the Guggenheim start to go up, I mean, I was always wandering around my neighborhood looking at construction projects because I was a little boy and they were really cool. But when I saw the Guggenheim start to take shape, it completely blew my mind. I just thought, this is a building. And I watched, I was just completely stunned. As soon as it opened, you know, I had to just go into, I was amazed that I was even allowed to go inside this thing, because it was so obviously not a building. And meanwhile, you know, my parents were responding to what was probably a fairly common reaction in New York, that, you know, what the heck is that? Mm-hmm. You know, what are they thinking? And there goes the neighborhood. Things like that. But it's interesting. I wonder if one of the influences towards, you know, the modern approaches to painting in the most general sense might also have been that museums became established and people began to have access to these vast collections of classical works, where, you know, a century before, not very many people got to see them. Mm-hmm. So maybe that, you know, there was kind of an overloading of the senses when you suddenly have all these periods jammed together into one, you know, gigantic environment.
Well, and speaking of gigantic environments, museums, the Louvre is the most jam-packed of all, you know, and only goes up to 1900, you know, yeah, in their collected works. And the uproar when Iampe designed the glass pyramid, yeah, for the courtyard was the similar, you know, I'm sure similar to, yeah, when they made the Guggenheim. But your connection between Egyptian form and contemporary art is right, you know, perfectly applicable to that, because it is an absolutely perfect thing to me in the middle of that courtyard. It's at night when the lights are on, you know, it's just so magical. And that form does relate to the ancient art that's in there.
Sure. Well, it evokes, you know, the elements that are at work in all classical paintings.
Yeah.
But another thought that came to mind when you're talking about the abstract aspect of classical composition and in the composition itself. And I was thinking how analogous that is to what we often talk about as the presentation of the art or the exaltation of the art in the gallery. Because placement is everything. I mean, placement and composition are essentially the same thing. And so you have these formidable, you know, layouts that have been designed to exalt the content and to position it in hierarchies of exalt and importance. And it's, you know, you could take very mundane things, just as, you know, we did in the previous century, and present them that way in oil, and they would, you know, you'd be kind of doing the same, making the same statement about how the context almost is more important than the content.
And when you're talking about the placement in a gallery and exalting the work of art, immediately I thought back to the old salons where they would just like jam as many paintings on the walls from floor to ceiling as possible.
Much of what we take for granted now as the modern movement was a reaction to how it was then. It was everything. Whenever you went to look at art, they tried to cram the art into every square inch of the museum or the annual salon or whatever. And so to make a simple piece, and I think that they were somewhat influenced by, in the late 19th century, Oriental art and Japanese art had a strong influence on European thinking. And I think that there was this sort of aha that went off in some people's minds about the density of all these forms and history and all this stuff that was that was considered to be European art. And then they would see a beautiful teacup coming from the Orient, or some simple branch coming down with nothing but silence around it. That had to have blown their minds. And I think much that we see that has come out of modern, or the early strokes of modernism, had to do with simple acts of beauty and a simple statement of beauty. Because those grand historical paintings that are 15 feet wide are so complex, you almost can't say they're beautiful. Really, a Da Vinci or something is beautiful. The wholeness in there is blows your mind. But in general, those historical paintings, it's like they're dark and complex, and there's all this story being told. And you look over here at a flower. Let's say a flower pot was standing on a pedestal next to that painting. I could see easily thinking beauty, complex story. You know.
Yeah. Well, my own experience looking at how I approach the abstract, it's mostly, I mean, I think about it mostly in terms of photography. My sound work is so intrinsically abstract, I don't have to, mostly I'm trying not to let it get concrete. But in the case of photography, where it is so effortlessly concrete, what has always fascinated me is finding the non-representational things that are in our field of vision all the time. And I have less trouble doing that through a camera than I do just looking at the world through my eyeballs, because I take things seriously when I see them in real life, and I can, you know, I have some distance between myself and the object when I look at it through a camera. And that's why even when I'm shooting an exhibit at Icon, I want to put the camera on the wall looking down the whole length of the gallery and just get the edges of all the paintings. And that, to me, that's much more interesting than actually photographing the paintings.
Well, yes, and that brings up the old story of that the blob of paint on the palette is more intrinsically beautiful than what we tend to do with it on the page, which tends to be limited by our own minds and abilities.
Yeah.
Yeah, Kandinsky has some there are some wonderful quotes by Kandinsky of his sort of love affair with the blobs of paint on his palette and specific relationship to specific colors. And there's this wonderful quote where he then feels tremendous gratitude to them for allowing him to mix them and use them to create something new. Just like they're just his little friends.
I think we have to thank Kandinsky and those pioneers for giving us permission to enjoy things directly and simply. You know, it was impossible to bring to that level of appreciation all of the aspects of life and the simple elements of form before that. You know,
yeah.
It had to be turned into something. It was very European, the whole concept. It had to be turned into something grand and filled with meaning and bona fide and all this.
Well, and Kandinsky very much was, like we said before, concerned with synthesis. And one of the concerns was to bring together the outer impressions that he saw every day in the world and fell in love with, and the inner experiences that were sometimes not even related to that, but that interacted with those outer impressions. And in his paintings, he tried to represent that blending of those two. His later paintings, too, some of them are very organic kind of forms because he looked under a microscope for the first time those years, and actually just blew his mind that this was reality, these little cells with all these colors and all that, and you can see that in his later paintings.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.